This episode of Hodinkee Radio is brought to you by Accutron and the new DNA Casino Collection. With 100 pieces made in four vibrant colors, the Accutron DNA Casino perfectly fuses futuristic watchmaking and bold design. Stay tuned later in the show for more on the brand's new collection, or visit AccutronWatch.com for all the details. Welcome back to Hodinkee Radio. I'm editor Tony Traina. Today I've got managing editor Danny Milton with me. Danny, how are you doing today?
Hey, Tony. Doing well. How about you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. No one ever asks how the host is doing.
Glad to be here for you.
I've also got fashion editor Malaika Crawford. Malaika, how are you doing today?
I asked you how you were last time I was on, Tony.
That's true.
Short memory Traina over here.
Yeah, the world's smallest violin for me. All right. Well, listen, guys, today we're going to be talking about watch proportions, what watch brands are getting right, and what we want to see more of. We're using an article by our own fashion editor, Malaika, here, titled The Plea for Proportionality, that we published a couple of weeks ago as a jumping off point for our discussion. To me, Malaika's article is actually making the simple point that brands need to look at what collectors, enthusiasts are really wearing and asking for, and offer more watches in more sizes. Of course, the supposed trend to smaller watches has been a big point of discussion the past couple of years, but Malaika's making a bigger point than just that brands should start making more watches in the 33 to 37 millimeter range. While some smaller and mid-size releases have garnered headlines, there's evidence that, at large, average watch sizes haven't actually gotten much smaller, though options have certainly increased the past couple of years. In fact, as Malaika and I discussed with Ben just a couple of weeks ago, this plea for proportionality is actually something that I'd argue dates back to the early days of Hodinkee. When Hodinkee started, luxury watches were all about big and complicated. Hodinkee started by focusing on smaller, wearable, heritage-inspired, often vintage watches. Nowadays, tastes are much broader than ever before, and that's creating a new demand on brands to recognize that good things can come in small, medium, and large packages. So today, Malaika and Danny and I are going to talk about proportions. Before that, though, we've got some catching up to do. I'm going to start with Danny, who is fresh off of the red carpet in New York for the premiere of Dune 2 with Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, and others. Danny, how was
Chalamet.
That?
Yeah, I think it's Zendaya and Chalamet, but we'll give you a pass on both, Tony. We'll give you a pass.
Well, listen, apologies to Mr. Apologies to Mr. Timothy. And Danny, give me the movie review. Give me the watch spotting from Dune 2, sure. Whatever you'd like.
So I met a lot of movie review folks at this red carpet, and I know we're still in pre-spoiler review embargo mode, so my review will be spoiler-free, but I would just tell anybody who's into Dune and enjoyed the first film to rush to the theater to see this movie. It's pretty remarkable piece of cinema for a sci-fi film, and I tremendously enjoyed it. I was in New York for the New York premiere, which was the final premiere in a string of global premieres, so I think the cast of that movie sat through a 2 hour and 20 minute film like six times.
Don't they sometimes leave and like go to dinner?
Well, I think, but in this case, I'm pretty sure they all just sat there because this, and I'll tell you why, this was the only premiere with an after party that I'm aware of. So spoiler alert on that. And it was, the after party was cool as well. They had it at the Natural History Museum. And it was a very much just like a bunch of the actors just mixing it up with a lot of influencers, TikTokers, and watch media. So, you know, standard fare. But very cool. And the red carpet was more of like a sandy orange carpet.
Oh, naturally. Well, listen, we know Hamilton is kind of known for placing things in cinema nowadays. Anything cool from Dune that you want to discuss that's watch related?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, look, I wrote the piece maybe a week ago about how Hamilton, in full Hamilton fashion, worked on the film both from the sense of making an on-screen prop, which was a wrist device worn by the characters on screen, although you can see it in the movie and it's quite visible. We don't know why it's there or what it does, which I'd be curious to know if there's a third film. And then they also made two limited edition Ventura models inspired by that wrist device, one of which is, to my understanding, a brand new digital technology for Hamilton. So it has the display in like a vertical instrumentation of the time with a light that lights up when you press a button in the crown, and it actually strobes, sort of gets to its brightest point and then flickers out in a really cool way. So a very cool watch, an even cooler movie, and it's just nice to see Hamilton continue to be involved in the movies. And just so the audience is clear, Hamilton doesn't do product placement. They don't pay to have their watches on the screen. They actually have a very organic affiliation with movies, so it's just cool to see that continue.
Well, there you have it, everyone. Run, don't walk to see Dune 2 whenever it comes to theaters near you. I think it will have opened by the time this publishes. So
definitely, because it opens February 29th is the opening. So if we're watching this next week, March something, the movie will be open.
Well, Malaika, you and I haven't been on any red carpets lately. I don't think.
Can I just use this opportunity to shout out Zendaya's outfit at the LA premiere, which was an Archive Mugler outfit that was sort of like robot wear.
Did you mean Zendaya at the London Dune premiere?
Maybe it was London, but she's wearing an archival Mugler.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Isn't it so cool? You probably think it's trash, but I love it.
No, it's called like the Cyborg or something crazy.
It's cool.
It's
like archive, like 1995 or something. I don't even care if you don't like fashion. You need to go see this. It's a good outfit. Anya Taylor-Joy was wearing a very weird outfit, but she was also wearing a JLC.
Yeah, she was wearing like a tiny little caliber 101, which was very cool. Very cool.
Like the queen.
One of the new segments we've been doing on the new iteration of Hodinkee Radio is collecting advice. We usually throw it in at the end of the show. We're not going to do it today. There's no time. We've got so many things to talk about. But you published an article that I thought was kind of fun the other day about vintage Chopard that I thought we could just talk about for just a few minutes. Kind of a collecting advice in a way for people that are looking for weird and crazy Chopards, bracelets, bangles, dual time zones, quadruple time zones, all kinds of weird things. I think you're using Elton John as kind of the jumping off point to talk about Chopard, but anything exciting about this era of Chopard or why you decided to even write about that for a little bit?
So it sort of spans many eras. And I think Chopard is definitely a brand that does not get as much love as it deserves, whether it be modern Chopard or vintage. And I was at the Elton preview with you, and I'd already seen this Imperial chronograph come up at auction before, like different iterations of it, but the fully yellow gold gem set with the sapphires, I'd seen it come up. In fact, Zoe Abelson, who's a dealer and she's been on Hodinkee before, we like send pictures to each other of this watch, like, you know, whenever it pops up. So when I saw it in real life, I was so like, I felt that excitement, like that full body rush whenever I see something that I love and I just want to try it on and touch it and it's all shiny and perfect to me. And I went home and I sort of did this deep dive that lasted, I'm not kidding, like multiple hours, me on the internet, countless cups of tea. Yes, English people drink tea. And I came across all these weird, like 70s, 90s, 80s that span across every single decade. And I thought, actually, some of these watches are like way more tastefully executed than a lot of the bigger brands that we're seeing come up at the moment, notably on Instagram. I know that Piaget is, Tony, it's going to be this running joke I have with you.
Like how long until we mention Piaget? Yeah.
But you know, all those like crazy cuffs that have come up at Sotheby's and on the Keystone and like those really retro, honestly, are a little bit too disco fever for my taste. Like I get the appeal, but to me, that is just, the 70s was this moment of like sheer insanity where there were no rules and everything just almost looked like kind of gross. Like it was just, the taste level was questionable. But what I loved about the Chopard vintage was weirdly, it was like executed in this very kind of refined way. Like the stone dial cuffs are all done really beautifully. They look like they belong in a high jewelry collection. It was just, I've been watching The Feud, Truman Capote and the Swans, and it was kind of giving me that vibe, like Babe Paley, just like these like high society women wearing really luxe watches. And honestly, the price point on some of these things is kind of low. But I would say 70s are amazing for this sort of, they were really, really good at executing the sort of geometric stone dial thing, or not dial, but more like dial and then cuff. And then also an era I kind of left out was the 90s, just because I felt like they were pretty tame in comparison. But Tony, I know you're a, what was that watch you sent me? The Monte Carlo.
That's right.
Tony,
so
Tony's never going to talk to me again.
Okay, first of all, I liked this article because for me, like, Chopard watchmaking kind of had always begun at the introduction of the LUC collection in 1996, 1997, when they decided they were going to build their own in-house movement, and they made the beautiful micro rotor movement that they just released last year again in the steel and copper salmon dial that, you know, enthusiasts really love. And from there, they started adding complications, GMTs, tourbillons, etc. So that's kind of where Chopard watchmaking had begun to me. So I'm glad that someone like you introduced me to earlier eras of Chopard that are exciting in different ways. But yeah, Malaika had asked me to contribute to this article to choose a weird and funky Chopard watch. And I chose one that was kind of a cross of a, like an ellipse and I don't know, something else.
I know
the Monte Carlo. The Monte Carlo for
it
those,
kind of looks like that AP that's like the, what do they call it? The pajama, like the stripey. Have you seen that watch before?
Oh, sure. Like the zebra?
Yeah. It kind of reminded me of that.
Yeah. Well, I chose this watch. I sent it over to Malaika, even wrote a little bit about it, and she just didn't even include it in the article. It wasn't crazy enough for her. So I've learned my lesson. When Malaika says she's something weird or crazy, you really have to do your worst. But that's the story about Chopard.
Well, Tony, I liked your choice, but my whole sort of thesis was like this jewelry watch crossover that we see from Piaget, Cartier, Bulgari, even now Boucheron, like people embrace that. They've sort of let go of this watch snobbery and decided to, I mean, it's like, it's not like Cartier back in the day was sort of making complicated watches, you know? So I think if we're worshiping at the altar of Cartier, let's like look at some other things too, you know? And even this idea that a lot of the designs may be, you know, motifs that other brands have used, I think that's okay. And I think brands pick and choose from each other. And there was even a Serpenti in the mix. And I'm like a devout Bulgari Serpenti girl. Everybody knows that. I'm never, ever, ever giving in my allegiance to Bulgari. But so what? They made a snake watch and a ton of other brands that used snakes as motifs across the board in jewelry. So it was like, okay, this is fun and cool and it looks weird and why not? And also shout out to Phil Toledano because we dissed him last episode or the episode before. But I think he deserves an honorable mention for this skeleton samurai.
That's right. I saw that watch when he bought it in Miami. The San Moritz has never been my favorite sort of 80s watch, if I'm being completely honest with you. But the skeleton one is cool. And I do like the San Moritz because it is kind of a very Chopard take on the sports watch of the era that was so cool, even if they were a little bit late to the party, if we're being honest.
Well, okay. Final fact. But also, I don't really care if they were late to the party. Because... cool. I mean, whatever. In the end, like, I think it looks good. And they actually were really early to the rainbow trend, which I discovered on my little dig. Like, they were doing rainbow in 1984, which is like slightly after Rolex did a rainbow Cellini. But I think that was a cool fact.
Should we do a little wrist checking before we dig into the main topic? See what we're all wearing.
Tony's trying to ban wrist checks.
Uh-oh.
As long as Malaika goes first, because I was shocked, I tell you, to see what she has on her wrist.
So am I.
Please, Malaika, go first.
Why would you be shocked?
I am G-Shocked.
Are you G-Shocked?
I'm G-Shocked.
I'm wearing Ben Clymer's G-Shock.
There we go.
Hoodinky G-Shock. What? You got to support the fam. Come on.
100%. You got to. I mean, I'm wearing a Hoodinky strap. That's got to count for something.
Yeah. Guys, I like to shock. It's what I live for.
Yeah, well, speaking of, I don't know if we can get too close to it, but I'm wearing a special Hodinkee Unimatic as well. But it's a Unimatic U1, and I love Unimatic. I visited them in Milan before, and glad to finally have one in the little watch box for myself. Danny, what about you?
I'm wearing my Submariner in full support of proportionality. I'm wearing my, I guess, technically 39mm sub on the Hodinkee Reed strap. I wear this one pretty often. Been switching up straps recently more than usual. I'm usually a bracelet guy, trying out the strap thing.
Ooh, yeah, that strap is it's an interesting look.
Yeah, it's different. I'm not sure if that was a compliment or not. Let's move on, maybe.
Well, if you have to ask, it certainly was not. We're excited that Hodinkee Radio is back, and our return is thanks in part to this week's sponsor, Accutron, and its new DNA Casino Collection. Driven by the world's first electrostatic energy movement, the new Accutron DNA Casino Collection fuses vibrant colors with futuristic design. The four bold new colors, each limited to 100 pieces, are inspired by the bright lights of Las Vegas. The DNA is an update of Accutron's original icon, the Space View, the watch known for its revolutionary tuning fork movement. The DNA updates the Accutron Space View for the modern era with a 45mm stainless steel case and integrated rubber strap. Since introducing the world's first fully electronic watch in 1960, Accutron has continued to push the boundaries of timekeeping. The Accutron DNA Casino Collection synthesizes bold colors, innovative technology, and a retro-futuristic design to make a bold statement. Accutron, it's not a timepiece, it's a conversation piece. Check out the new DNA Casino Collection on AccutronWatch.com or the new Citizen Flagship Store in New York. A big thanks to Accutron for its support, and now, back to the show. Let's get to the main point of today's discussion, the plea for proportionality, as Malaika called it a couple of weeks ago. I kind of introduced the topic at the top, but Malaika, I want to start here, if that's okay with you, with what you call your eureka moment in the article. You say it's not collectors or enthusiasts who are slow to the mark when it comes to cultivating a fresh perspective or aligning with a modern attitude. It's the brands who are mostly responsible for creating the impression that the watch world has stayed. So maybe we can kind of pick up right there and talk about what you mean by that, and then zooming out and talking about perhaps why you even decided to write this article. Why this article, and why now even?
You know this is going to get deep, Tony. But no, in all seriousness, it's something I think about probably every day since I've been in the watch world. Danny knows. I talk about it incessantly. There was a lot of thought that went into this article, I'll tell you that. It started with a How to Wear It, where I styled three small 33mm-ish size watches. And I was trying to frame my argument there, and it sort of got me thinking about how there are always these enthusiasts yelling about the size of watches on Instagram, like going on and on and on about small watches for men. And usually I sort of avoid getting involved in that conversation, and I feel like it's not really my sort of place to get involved in. I don't want to start, you know, spreading fire wherever I go. But I sort of sat and thought about it, and I realized that if you really think about what these enthusiasts are asking for, they're kind of asking for exactly the same thing that I'm asking for, which is just like more thought and consideration and more varied design and size across the board. It's less of a let's, you know, change gender labels, and more just like let's cater to everybody's taste, as opposed to sort of saying small watches are men and large watches are women. What about a sort of small, medium, and large for whoever wants it? Which seems like such a logical answer. And I went through this whole sort of journey of, well, why don't these men who want smaller watches just wear vintage watches and like stop yelling about it? But vintage watches are difficult. It's a whole different ball game. You have got to find the dealer. You've got to find good condition. Like, it's a whole slippery slope. And why is it that these watch brands are just so slow to the mark? And I mean, talking about watch size to me is one of those things that I find truly monotonous. Like, how many times can we talk about it? But actually, we kind of do need to talk about it, because it seems like this weird topic, or rather this weird area that the watch brands just like can't quite seem to understand. And it's giving off this kind of like super antiquated approach, when everybody who's deeply into watches, or, you know, like partakes in the hobby, like all of us have varying ideas of like what's cool and interesting. And I just think the brands are not really taking note of that.
Yeah, I'd be remiss, first of all, not to kind of note Mark Cho, who always does this watch size survey and kind of finds that around 36 millimeters is like the ideal proportion size. Obviously, the people that are responding to a survey by a guy who runs a menswear shop is kind of a self-selecting group. So yeah. we'll acknowledge that bias up front. But there's some truth to, I'm sure, what he discovers there, that in general, watch sizes and wrist sizes are often a little bit smaller than you would be led to believe if you just look at what brands are releasing year to year. Danny, I'm curious, from your perspective, how have brands changed their approach to smaller or mid-size watches over the past few years, if at all?
I think it's been just a few, like a small handful, to be honest with you. Malika and I had a really long conversation about this sort of in advance of both of these stories, sort of like trying to get to the core of what this topic is. So I've had a lot of time to think about this too. And we got to a few points, one of which being like just commercial products in general and the normal watch consumer. And if you were to ask like a handful of brands, like similar to the Mark Cho survey, probably what the ideal wrist size of their consumer is, I bet you it might land around 42 millimeters. Just because like I find that when you talk to brands like Omega, for example, and what their best sellers are, it's probably, you know, the Seamaster Diver or even larger Planet Oceans. And there's a reason why Rolex took its Submariner to 41 millimeters. I think there's like an understanding that despite the enthusiasts, the off the street, you know, normal person who's not dreaming about watches every day is looking for something bigger. And you see the same thing. I'm not a car guy, but indisputably you see the same thing in the automotive world. Like cars are bigger, they're longer, they're beefier, they're chunkier. They lack that kind of charm. And so you really only see it in brands that embrace heritage. So the brands that I see it happening with, you know, obviously Tudor, the Black Bay 54 was a watch that is still like shockingly random to me. I love it. I appreciate that it exists. No one is doing that. The only brand that I saw do that before actually was two of them. Rolex with the 37 millimeter Yachtmaster, but that was in precious metal. And then even Omega, I believe, had a 37 and a half millimeter Planet Ocean. Sometimes when brands do that on paper, that seems really good. And then you see it in person and the dials are so tiny that the watches actually look and wear more like 34, 33. And that's a very strange thing for a dive watch. I'm rambling a little bit here, but my point is like, no one's thinking about the enthusiast core. And in a way, whether it's a small group, it is a loud group. And so I think it's a vocal minority. So other heritage-leaning brands I want to shout out. Panerai recently with their new sort of Rod Diomir in smaller sizes. And then even Omega. I think the Speedmaster 57 is a good example. I think the first Omega in space a few years ago is a good example. But these are all specialty pieces. Like every watch I'm naming, those are not sort of their mass produced marquee. You're not going to see them on billboards when you're driving into town for the local jeweler or on a, you know, big screen in Times Square. So it's a strange, it's a muddled field. It's trying to please the enthusiasts with like one or two SKUs and hoping that they'll be quiet while continuing to sort of make everything large and in charge.
Yeah, it's funny you brought up Omega. Go ahead, Malika, sorry.
No, I was just going to say off the back of that, it's really important to make that point that the average consumer probably doesn't give a beat. Like, and that's like part of the conversation I'm having, right? And that's why I'm asking for different sizes. Yeah. I'm not saying make watches small again. I'm saying make some mid-size watches in addition, please.
And make them the same as the ones in the larger size. Like
precisely. Like,
exactly.
Because we know you can, so right. Just do it.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of my big sort of beefs historically. I think I'm going to land this by talking about the midsize Vacheron Overseas, just to kind of point you guys to where I'm going. But oftentimes what these brands will do, Vacheron, for example, they used to have a 37 millimeter Overseas, I believe, and they had an off-center seconds at like 9 o'clock. To kind of remind you that it's not the Overseas that a lot of people actually want. Patek with their Nautilus kind of does this, in my opinion.
I was going to say the
they
same
swap
thing.
Swap out like, the hands.
You know, it's not the Nautilus.
Yeah, it's not like when back in the day when they would do the 37 and the 3800, and from, you know, 10 feet away, you would not know those watches apart because they're the exact same. And at some point along the way, maybe it's more modern in more modern times, but they decided that they needed to do different design cues to distinguish between the big one that's the hot one that people want and this type of thing, and the quote unquote lesser version or the perceived lesser version. And surely there's all kinds of commercial reasons and otherwise for that. But that's why I kind of, when I wrote up the Vacheron Overseas in 35 millimeters that they did last year, that they just released last year, almost a year ago now, I really like that they made it the exact same as the 41 millimeter Overseas. All of the design cues are the exact same. It's just for a smaller watch. It's not perfect to me. Actually, Danny, to your point, I think the one thing they could have done is made the dial opening like a little bit bigger, yep, to make it wear a little bit bigger, because that's kind of what happens when you shrink down these watches. Sometimes if you keep the dial to bezel ratio the same, I guess, it feels a little bit too small or a little bit too diminutive. But anyway, huge props to them for doing that, because it's something that no other brand is doing. And especially if you're a brand like Vacheron, it's a way to really distinguish yourself in the marketplace. So we talk all the time about, oh, there must not be commercial demand for it. Well, on the off chance that there is, like, Vacheron just went out there and staked their claim to that market. But Danny, it's funny you brought up Omega at the top, because I was literally on their website yesterday, and they have on the very first page of their website, they have their bestsellers, and it's the watches that you mentioned and that you would imagine. It's two or three Speedmasters and then two or three Seamaster 300s, which are, you know, all above 40 millimeters, of course. So
yeah, they're like 42 and up. Yep.
Yeah. So there's no indication that there's a broader sort of demand for these types of things, nor are the biggest brands, Rolex and Patek, necessarily getting smaller at any type of scale. So there's all kinds of opportunity for a brand like Vacheron and others to find places in the market to address what we see as a potential need for enthusiasts, at least.
Well, look, I'm telling you, I mean, these brands are not stupid. They're not going to pour R&D into the watches when they get released that we look at. You know, every year, most brands release two or three SKUs for the enthusiast, four or five SKUs for everybody else. And we sometimes look at those and hesitate if we even want to cover them, because they're either gargantuan, extremely modern, or have some sort of just like craziness to them. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, there is a reason that these exist. But beyond that, I mean, to your point about Vacheron and to Malaika's point, I mean, what Tudor is doing is sort of the blueprint where each can be different. Like the Black Bay 41, the Black Bay 58, and the Black Bay 54 are not identical. But as you get smaller, none of them are worse than the largest one. They're just variations on the theme, each pulling from a different sort of heritage point and each uniquely interesting, but none of them feel like a budget Black Bay.
Yeah.
So you don't have to make them all identical, right? I mean, Michael, what do you think about that?
I think that's why it made sense. I think that's why the watch resonated with me, because it was like, oh, this isn't just some diminutive version of
the
original. I mean, this whole point really does get me quite worked up and frustrated, because it's like, not only would these mid-sized watches serve the enthusiast, I think it would open up the pool to women, right? Like, I think you would then be allowing women more choice and variety, which would open up an entire segment of the market, if we want to think about, you know, the balance sheet here. And also, yes, I know watches take longer to manufacture and produce, and it's not like clothes or whatever, but it's like this idea that I think the watch brands are just so like afraid of change, and they're so sort of in servitude of the existing customer instead of like sort of making waves and making change and saying, actually, this is what we're doing and everybody's going to follow suit kind of thing. I mean, I'm not saying it has to be that extreme, but it's just quite sad when it feels like there's really a lack of originality, or it just feels so predictable.
And Malaika, I'm genuinely curious, because I know we're talking not just about watches being proportional for women, but being proportional for anybody that wants them to be, right? But
yeah,
that being said, when you think about, and, you know, me going for a Rolex example, but when you think about sort of the Rolex collection, and it's got to be, it is a choice for a woman to wear a quote unquote men's watch, right? So,
yeah.
And then generally speaking, you have very few models in a collection once you get smaller that adhere to what would be considered like a classic sports watch. Suddenly, at a certain point, they start putting diamonds on the dial. They start doing something to it that looks feminine, for lack of a better word. And really, like, in my brain, the only watch that exists, like, in a from a brand like Rolex who can afford to take those risks is like a 34 millimeter OP, or, you know, like a 30, if I don't even think there is a 30, there's no 34 millimeter Datejust. So really, the 34 millimeter OP on an Oyster bracelet, but like, that's it. But if there were more of those, right, if other models took that route, and I think that women would be less, it'd be less of a choice, and it would feel less like you're wearing a man's watch, right? I mean,
I just think you'd just be wearing a watch.
Exactly, right.
Which is why I wear an Explorer 1 every single day when I'm not wearing a Serpenti. But like, I see women wearing OPs everywhere.
Right.
There's a reason for that, because it's like the most like non-gendered, you know, versatile, robust watch.
It's up a price bracket, but the other brand that strikes me as doing things relatively well is AP, obviously. Yeah. And the black ceramic Royal Oak is the one that I think of the most. Bryn did a great video of it a couple of years ago. But to me, it's like the Black Bay 54 in a way, where it's something doing something different with the Royal Oak at a smaller size, but it puts just as much thought and takes different inspiration and uses different materials and all of these types of things that you don't see at other sizes of the Royal Oak.
Yeah, I think AP is probably the only brand currently who, I mean, they make so many different Royal Oaks in 34 and 37.
And they always like have, to and be clear. Like, even
Yeah, they're like all over the shop with their sizes, you know, and that's just how it is. And that, to me, makes the most sense.
Well, it's kind of like, to your OP point, if you're at the next... If you want to spend the next jump in money, whatever that is, it's the Royal Oak for like that next level of wealth to me, in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Let's also shout out Chopard for a second. I mean, the Alpine Eagle 37-41, you know, split is in line with what we're talking about in a way. Again, I think that watch feels slightly small at 37. It has that whole, as you put it, Tony, the dial to bezel ratio makes it feel smaller, but still, they launched a watch in two size segments that kind of hit what we're talking about, to the point where like our buddy James Stacy would rather buy the 37 millimeter model. And that's kind of interesting to me.
Yeah. The other one at a totally different price back bracket that I've been beating on a little bit on the website is the Tissot PRX, and how much I love the 35 millimeter. To me, they're missing a 37 millimeter, but you know, there are options, more options than there were 5 years ago, but it still seems at scale in the watch industry, things are missing, I think, is kind of the idea that we're circling around here.
Yeah, there's a lot missing. The PRX is a good one. I bought that for my brother for Christmas, actually.
Hey, which one did you get?
I got the blue dial.
Nice. Yeah, it's classic.
He loves it, and he is not a watch enthusiast.
Malika, what's a brand that you think should spearhead something that isn't doing it, but could probably afford the risk?
The obvious brand.
Yeah.
Rolex. I mean, everyone's like, yeah, but they'll never do that. And it's like, well, okay, sure, but why not?
Do you think things like the having a 36 and a 40 millimeter Explorer is the reverse of that? They start small, then went big?
God, I really didn't like the 40 millimeter Explorer.
You told me it was too big on me when I tried it on last year.
Yeah, I just, it just doesn't make sense to me anyway.
Oh, I agree.
Please keep making 41 millimeter watches. I talk about the offshore all the time. I love offshore. I love how loud and big it is. But can you also make the mid-size equivalent? But that is what I'm requesting. And I made that joke about dreaming about a 37 millimeter Submariner. Can you imagine what would happen if they made a 37 millimeter Submariner? Like, people would freak out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, totally. Danny would put it on a leather strap.
I mean, that, like, but what I hate is that when I make these sort of suggestions, everybody's, oh, don't be so ridiculous. like as if I'm asking for, I don't know.
Stranger things have happened. For sure.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up question for you, Malaika. You've made a point that I quite like before, something to the extent of, you say sometimes it's nice to have no gender in watch design. I think that's some of the stuff we've been talking about, like the Tissot PRX, even the Vacheron Overseas. Other times you like to see intentional design for women and you think it makes sense. I'm wondering, I've seen you write something similar maybe once or twice. I'm wondering if you could kind of just unpack this idea a little bit.
So, and it is quite complicated, this whole idea of gender in watches. And it's not a one note argument. It's like very layered. But I do think that the reason why watches such as the Benoit Bangle and, you know, Carolina Bucci for AP, the reason why those watches do so well is because they really take into account how modern women are dressing and how women are accessorizing, and they're like really paying attention to consumer taste. And like having a jewelry designer come over to a watch brand is a very clever thing to do, because they sort of understand the way women shop, the what they're looking for, what is kind of cool right now, or what will be timeless rather. It's a different brain sort of science when it comes to making jewelry. And I think there's so much room for crossover between the watch and jewelry space. I mean, there are so many jewelry designers who are dying to make watches. And the Benoit Bangle, I wonder if that was created by Marie-Laure at Cartier, because when I saw that watch at Watches and Wonders, I mean, it's not the most like shocking design ever, but I was like, oh my God, they obviously are clearly paying attention to what women are wearing and how women want to wear their watch. And it's like a piece of jewelry without diamonds all over it. And that's intentional design. It's like thinking about what women want to wear without it having to be some unisex idea. It's like sometimes women like to wear, I hate the word feminine, but like to wear sort of feminine things. There's nothing wrong with that. I love Serpenti. And actually Fabrizio from Bulgari once said to me, Serpenti's a piece of jewelry with a watch on it. But there's actually nothing wrong with that. And so I think it's like about embracing intentional design and getting more women involved.
Do you think that like celebrity, not product placement, but like organic celebrity appearance actually helps move the conversation? I'm thinking a callback to our buddy Timothée Chalamet, who's famously wearing like tiny Cartier, you know, on stuff that like is decidedly not designed for a man's wrist. But, you know, you'll see him courtside at a Knicks game where you'd have to get like a magnifying glass to your computer screen to even see what's on his wrist. I mean, do you think that kind of stuff over time, these things take time, but like over time, these help push us in the right direction, or at least push trends?
100%. Yeah. Like there is absolutely no denying it.
Yeah.
Like I don't even think the small watch trend would be as much of a thing as it is if it were not for Timothée Chalamet and the other celebrities doing it. Like, you know, I love all our friends on Instagram, but they're not doing that. That's,
of course. Right.
Yeah.
We're banging it. We're bruising our foreheads on a really hard stone wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It kind of, Malaika, it reminds me of where we started this conversation, just talking about your Chopard article and exploring all of these weird designs from the 60s and 70s and up to the 90s. And if you look at a lot of the catalogs of these modern watch brands, you'd be hard pressed to find that much variety in the catalogs in what they're doing and what they're trying to do with their more jewelry focused watches. And I think to your point, it would be worth exploring those types of things again, you know?
It's just like, I don't understand it. I truly find it sort of confusing because there are so many resources available and there are amazing jewelry designers doing amazing things who would give their sort of right arm to work with a big watch brand. And I think it's kind of clever that AP cottoned onto that so early on, because I do feel like this is something that could become a thing.
Are there any specific sort of I guess it's a collaboration, but any specific things that you would call for, brands or crossovers that you would love to see that would just blow your mind?
You know, I really think Tiffany needs to sort it out, because they could really make some fire watches if they like they could. Can you imagine like an Elsa Peretti watch crossover, like some sort of sculptural amazing thing? There's just, I feel like there's so much potential. I could write you a list the size of, you know, I don't know, but I have ideas if anybody wants them.
I'm so glad you brought up Tiffany. This is something I thought about somewhat recently, that they're sitting on like essentially a gold mine of all kinds of things on the side of that we've been talking about, but on the more men's unisex side as well. I mean, yeah. I think the East West is kind of cool. They used to make these old calendars by Movado, all kinds of things from Movado, obviously the Patek relationship. But now that they're owned by LVMH, it feels as though it should only be a matter of time before Tiffany watchmaking is, it feels to me as though it's due for a real revival.
And I also want to point out that I know tastes vary across markets, right? Like the Asian market is shopping differently to the US market. I think, you know, Japanese women, for example, prefer smaller watches. I've spoken to multiple editors from Japan who are like, yes, a lot of women who are just, you know, like general consumers prefer smaller watches. And so I reckon that, you know, the brands are catering to other markets. But I just, again, it's that argument of, okay, I'm not saying make, you know, millions of units of our mid-sized dreams. Just like, you know, I'm sure they can figure it out.
I was having this conversation with someone just this morning, actually. We've been having some Watches and Wonders preview sessions, seeing things that may or may not be coming out in the next couple of months. So I won't mention the brand specifically, but some of the stuff was just not really hitting the mark on the things that we've been talking about for the past 45 minutes. Things that enthusiasts like, things that we like to cover on Hodinkee. And the only thing that I could possibly think of as the explanation as to why is that it's just not geared towards our market specifically. It's not geared towards geographically our market, and then specifically the enthusiast market. It's geared towards the other side of the world specifically that you're mentioning. And that's something that we acknowledge. I think you acknowledged it in your article, but I think you say something like, please just come correct to each market, you know, like,
yeah,
if this isn't what is targeted towards us, like, that's fine, but please show us something that is as well.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, to be totally honest, I find this, here's a mother of pearl doll diamond indices, I just think at this point in 2024, like, it's just rude. so like, come on. Yeah, do better.
You know, in a way, this is kind of where I wanted to land this conversation. But if you look at watches from the 1990s, let's say, even, you can go back farther to other generations. But let's talk about the 90s just for a second. Malaika, just before this started, I saw that you sent me a gold Vacheron Overseas from the 1990s. That's like 25 millimeters. And it's just emblematic of, at the time, all of these brands were releasing watches across the size spectrum. Vacheron had an Overseas at pretty much every 2 millimeters. Tudor was making mid-size subs and mini subs in addition to the full size thing. Patek was releasing traditional size Calatravas that were the same size as the Patek 96. And at some point, I think the trend towards larger watches, these things just dropped off, but we've swung so far in the opposite direction now that hopefully these things will come back at some point across the board.
I mean, like we were saying the other day with Ben, it is a pendulum, obviously. I'm sure things will swing back in time, but I think this is more of an argument for like more intentional thought.
I mean, it also is the way I maybe see it happening is when things shifted, they shifted quickly. I think things went from being sleek and smaller to big, almost, you know, in one release cycle in a shocking manner. And maybe, you know, maybe we shouldn't have to accept the fact that it's going to take time. Like, maybe the pressure should be on the brands a little bit to like shock the other way. I mean, at a certain point, they also lead the charge in influencing what is and is not sort of in vogue and on trend in their own industry. And, you know, I honestly want to throw the onus back on the brands. I think that they couldn't possibly have known that people wanted, you know, what they delivered when, let's say, you know, things jumped from 36 to 40 being the norm to 42 to 45 being the norm. And so why not just give it a shot? I mean, I don't know. The thing that I noticed that bothers me, again, you know, taking the Submariner as an example, since we talked about having a 37 millimeter Submariner, is like the fallacy that we even have a 41 millimeter sub. It's not really. And it's like, what do case size numbers even mean for any watch? I mean, you think about Seiko versus, I don't know, Hublot. And it's like, two 44 millimeter watches are not alike in any way. I mean, you have to deal with like length of the case, and just like the general size of the dial. I mean, I have a watch with a dial aperture that has no bezel, and therefore a 42 millimeter watch feels like a 45. I mean, there's just so many factors that go into this. It's like, when I thought about proportionality, it just felt less like a size argument, even though I agree that we need to get there, but also feels like, let's just stop making maxi watches across the board. That's really like, yeah, where I think you could at least get the first dent into the industry.
I do have a last point that I think the generalist consumer, and I hate to be so sort of gauche, but you know, most people buying a watch, they want you to know what watch they're wearing. And if you're not an enthusiast, the point of you wearing a watch is likely to demark your sort of social standing. And that's where I think the sort of big watch trend kind of, that's where I think it comes from, right? It's like that loud period in fashion when logo mania really hit and everybody wanted to be flashy. And so it made sense. And if you're an average guy and you're buying the sort of gold standard of watch, you're likely getting a Rolex and you want people to know about it.
It's, yeah, true. Sure. It's at some true. Point along the way, big watch meant big shot. And so,
yeah,
it didn't used to be like that. I mean, it used to be what, gold watch in any size, you know, oftentimes 34 millimeters was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay, guys, I'm thinking we can land it here for the day. What would you like to see sort of from brands, that choose any brand, any watch, something you'd like to see that kind of riffs off of the discussion we just had? I can go first if you guys want to take a moment. Malika, hopefully I'm not stealing yours, but it's something that you produced. It was from Watches in the Wild. One of the guys you featured was wearing a Tudor mini sub. You know, those are 33 millimeters. Like I said, they made them in the 90s, but I thought it just looked so sick on that guy. And it would be so cool if that were in the catalog again for men and women. It's such a cool look. I'd love to see something like that come back. And hopefully I didn't steal one of your choices.
No, I think that's a sick choice.
I would throw it to Omega. I think Omega would have a lot of power in the industry if they started going small, because they've sort of established themselves as sort of the new go-to. You can walk into a boutique and get any watch you technically would like to get without, you know, meaningful wait lists. And so the Seamaster 300 being as popular as it is, I don't think that it carries the weighty heritage of the Speedmaster, and there's the ability to change it. I'd like to see that watch at like land at 38 millimeters, you know, somewhere in that target range. And I think that it would be a watch that a lot of people would be attracted to at that price point.
We could do an entire episode about Omega, to be honest with you, because I have so many ideas for them and things that things that they're doing well, but things that they could do better as well.
For sure.
Sorry,
for
Malika,
sure.
Go ahead.
No. The Omega thing, we should lean into that at some point. Because I bet we all have wild ideas. But aside from my 37 millimeter sub laughable dream, you know, I'd love to see a baby Aquanaut.
Yeah, like a proper baby Aquanaut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would love that. I don't really like small watches, but that is a small watch I would just wear every day. I think it's so sick.
I love the original 5060, 5066 were 36 millimeters. Love those on my wrist. And then they did the Quartz 4960, I want to say, that was 34 millimeters, even a little bit smaller. Love that idea too.
Yeah. And we'll say a 3800.
Yeah. Why not? Why not?
Why not go back to the classics? And also a mid-size 222, because again, we know you can do it.
Totally agree with that. Well, thanks for playing along with me, guys. Thanks, everyone at home, for listening to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. Thanks to our video and audio editor, Vic Ottomanelli. And we'll see you again next week for another episode.